Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
In this episode, you'll meet Stacy Westfall from Loudonville, Ohio. Stacy is one of the most beloved trainers and clinicians across disciplines because of her vast knowledge and delightful personality. Horses have always been and continue to be her happy place, and it's where the world makes sense to her. And you'll hear Stacy explain how one of the most humiliating rides of her life led to her discovering bridleless riding. And she later became a household superstar after her bareback and bridleless ride on her special mare, Roxy. And you'll hear Stacy's powerful and unique take on the connection between horse and rider. And she'll break things down for you into the rider's mind and body and the horse's mind and body, with the rider's mind being in the driver's seat. I know you're going to love and be enlightened by what Stacy has to say. Welcome. I'm so happy, just thrilled that you're with us. And thank you for taking your time, because I know life is busy and you have a lot going on. So welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I love talking with you. Like you said in one of our messages, if we live closer together, we'd be at coffee all the time.
Yes, we would. Well, maybe I'll just move to Ohio and take care of that. I'll come there in the summer and you come down here in the winter.
Now that sounds like a plan. That's a plan.
Well, Stacy, I think that pretty much the whole world knows who you are. But just in case they don't, I would like for you to give us a little bit of background to that famous ride that you had, and explain your experience on that ride and what it was like, your horse's name, just everything.
Yeah. So the ride you're referencing would be the bareback bridleless ride that I did to the song Live Like You Were Dying. Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting because the backstory would be, you know, it would be that in 2003, I actually did my first bridleless ride, and that was with a saddle, with a bridle, without the bridle. And I had actually gone to a show, dropped a rein at the show while I was showing in a traditional showing class where dropping a rein is not desirable. And I dropped a rein, picked it up, scooped it up off the ground while trying not to break any of the rules, was like just completely heartbroken that I had made this mistake that got me, you know, a penalty score of zero and, you know, removed from the class. Cause I was like, my horse did everything right. And then I messed it up, kind of a thing. But it was so funny because while I sat in the stands beating myself up for the rest of the day until all the customers were done showing so we could go home, people kept coming up and saying, that was amazing. I can't believe you like still had all that control while you were like, had your left hand behind your back while you're trying to pick up the right. Cause I was trying not to break any of the other rules. Like you can't touch your horse and you can't hold the saddle horn and you can't do. And like, I'm leaned over and I'm picking up the rein and we still run down and do this sliding stop. And they're like, that was amazing. So after all these people keep saying this to me, and meanwhile, I'm over there, I'm like beating myself up for the mistake I made. When I got home and I was at home and I was riding around, I was like, that was really kind of cool how much control I had. And that was kind of the dawning of my experimentation with the bridleless riding, not counting the 10 years prior when I took my barrel racing horse out of her combination Hackmore gag bit, put her in a halter, headed off down the trail, and thought that was a good transition towards bridleless. That one ended up with me being run away with for like a mile bareback. So then like here 10 years later, I am, and I'm like, wait a minute, I might be a little bit closer. And that was in, I think I dropped the rein in August, and I ended up entering the Quarter Horse Congress in October, bridleless. And then I totally tanked at that one. Not enough mental coaching. We'll just summarize it with that. because literally nothing changed between that ride and the next one except for the mental side. And then in December I did that bridleless ride at the NRHA Reigning for Charity, and that was the first time that I, you know, competed and won bridleless. Soon as I walked out, people were like, "How are you going to top that?" And you're just like, "I'm going to take a nap." And then later on, you know, it does plant the seed when people keep asking, "What are you going to do to top that?" And I'd played with riding that mare bareback and bridleless, but she was very rough. She had a pony stride and she was just very rough. And some of her maneuvers were just so physical. The saddle was really protecting, helping me balance. Uh-huh. And like, she had very high withers also. So there were several factors going on here. So then when, as Roxy was coming along, I showed her with the bridle. I mean, yeah, she was shown with a bridle. Then as a 4-year-old, I showed her in my wedding dress and bridleless, but with a saddle on. And then by the time I got done showing her as a 4-year-old bridleless, then I was like, okay, I'd been playing around in the background and she was much smoother. And I kept thinking, I can do this. And I remember the first time that I was riding her, not bareback, but with the bridle on at home. The first time I slid like, you know, 2 feet, I was like, wow, I just did that. And the first time I spun really slow, I was like, wow, you know, and then it just became this ever increasing challenge of like, you know, could this become competition level? Mm-hmm. And then that was when in 2006, I did that ride twice. I did it in September in Tulsa and I won with it down there. And then I did it in October at the Quarter Horse Congress, which is the one where my dad had just passed away. And mm-hmm. So that's the one that went viral.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like doing that ride? Was it emotional that evening? And
yeah, so, you know, I think in hindsight, I think it was definitely a blessing that I had done it in September because, mm-hmm. you know, I had been practicing it and I'd been doing it in demonstration form. Like I had used it as a demonstration type thing at Road to the Horse in the spring, like February or March. And then I'd been, you know, kind of dipping my toe in the water because, as you well know, there's the aspect of what you've done for the training, but there's also the aspect of the mental part of it. And I was very aware that the more you move 100% of this to your body, the more you better be 100% present and aware of what your body's doing, because that was essentially what had cost me my first bridleless ride, was that disconnect between my body and my mind. So because I had been experimenting with it, and especially I'd had that experience in the September show, then turning around and having my dad pass away and then deciding I've never done any intro for any of my rides aside from they just read who it is and I come in. And that was the only time I've ever dedicated a ride or done any of that. So I knew, you know, just from the, you know, just the emotional state of having just done, you know, the whole funeral, the whole sudden passing, the whole everywhere up to that. And then taking it there, it was just, for me, it was really, in the moment, you know, horses have always been my place of peace. Horses have always been my place where the world makes sense. So thankfully, having said that, it made it so that even though I was coming off from this really emotional time, that I could go into that show. And yes, one of the reasons the announcer's voice breaks is because you're supposed to turn in your intro in the morning practice at like, you know, 8 a.m. And I was draw three that night. And when draw one was in the arena, I walked up and handed it to him. And they kind of looked at me like, "This is illegal," and they left. But then you can tell why I did that, you know, because I knew the effect it was going to have on everything. And I knew I didn't want anybody else. I didn't want to spend the whole day with people talking about it. So you have to have your horse right up at the gate. And then somebody has to like nod and say, "Play the music. And we're starting at the gate." And so they do that. And I don't want to hear I don't want to hear the announcer. So I didn't listen to the announcer. I wrote what he was going to read. I didn't hear his voice crack. I didn't allow myself any of that. I had already put myself in the zone. I was already in my mental state, and the way that I could block the rest of that out, if you watch me sitting in the entryway, I'm talking to the people around me and I'm really animated. I'm really animated with my body because I'm fully immersing myself in, like, you know, the people that are waving, and I'm like very, because that was what I was using to not hear what was happening. I never heard that announcement until after, when I was watching the ride later.
Wow. So then when you rode, you were obviously in the moment, connected with Roxy. That's your mare's name. Yep. Right. Mm-hmm. And I can remember where I was in the barn, and someone sent that to me on the phone. And of course, I thought I was the only one that had ever seen it. Oh, I can't wait to share this with people. And anyway, the ending of it, Stacy rides her mare bareback and bridleless to this song. It's just magnificent. And then tell me about standing up on her at the end.
You know, it was kind of an interesting thing. So I had one rode to the horse in the spring. And at the time, the signature thing was to stand up. And I, like, couldn't quite figure out, like, you know, say I get done, because the timing on getting everything perfect, like as far as finishing your ride, it's sort of like, well, it could work out that I, you know, I finish right at the end of the music and I'm done, or it could work out that I finish and there's a little bit more music left to go or something, you know, something going on. So for me, when I'm planning those freestyle rides, there's going to be a few choices at the end that you're going to make. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, here's one thing I could do at the end if I wanted to. And so I did. And then it was kind of funny because I was like, okay, there's enough time, stand up. And then, so I stood up, and then it was so funny because my mom was there and I had asked her where she was going to be sitting. I'm going to rewind slightly. So when I was getting ready for Road to the Horse and I realized that this, like, it was this signature thing for people to stand up, I'm scared of heights. Mm-hmm. And yes, the height of the back of a horse is enough, like standing up on is yes, like enough to trigger me. And so I had spent the whole spring, like, getting myself to the point where I could, like, climb partway up around Pimpanel and stand and, like, hold my hands partway up and then, like, you know, like higher and higher and higher and, like, just getting more comfortable. Not ever really, it was never in my comfort zone. It was definitely still stretching me. So then I decide I'm going to do this. Well, I ask my mom where she's sitting, and she's sitting, I can only stand up on a horse's back facing one particular direction because it's the only way I practiced it. Uh-huh. So I know I'm going to stand up and I'm facing this way. My mom's the other side. And I was like, well, I guess I'm going to stand up, and then I'm going to try, if there's still time, I'll try turning around and waving to my mom. Because if I fall off, I'm done being judged anyway. And so it was just kind of a.
It was a beautiful salute to your dad. Really, yes. Beautiful. Well, Stacy, you just were talking about the whole mental side of it. And how do you, well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about when we first met each other, which I didn't even know we met each other. Because you were, that sounded like an oxymoron, but I came to speak at the University of Findlay, and you were a student there, and I think I came two different years, mm-hmm. And I met students, but of course, you know, it's not that I don't mean to not remember, but I didn't remember, mm-hmm. And then when you had your ride, that ride, I thought, I just really want to send my book, The Gift, to Stacy. And then you said, yes, I met you and at the university. So tell me about the beginning of thinking about mental skills and how it's evolved and just that journey, where it fits into your horse life now.
Yeah, I mean, you were really an introduction to it, because I just remember sitting in the classroom and I remember you talking about, you know, that we could create our emotions. And, you know, I'm the classic college student. We're like, okay. And then you're like, you know, then you offered an amount of money. Now that always gets a college student's attention. You were like, what if I were to offer X amount of dollars? I forget the actual amount. It felt like $10,000.
Yes. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like $10,000 if you could cry right now. And we're all like, yes. And so it was that light bulb moment of, okay, I see what she's going with now on the crying. So where else can this go? And, you know, and listened and just remember you like talking about like, you know, having like a physical. And so for me, I want to say you told us, but anyway, it was like touching your thumb and your finger tip together, the trigger and something that you could do like that. And I just remember grabbing onto that concept a little bit like a lifeline, because although I'd been around horses, you know, grown up around horses and been around them my whole life, my early, you know, it was like horses and horse showing. For me, horses were just like this amazing fun thing. And my mom and I would go to horse shows. I grew up in Maine and we would go to horse shows, and they were basically just like a gathering of people that had horses and you did some things. And then at some point we were like, I have no idea how I'm placing or not placing from one show to the next, which led me to barrel racing, because I could figure out the rules there, like fast, don't knock things down. I'm like, I got this. And so I didn't really understand competition very well. And then when I found myself at Findlay and I was doing all of this stuff, there was, you know, there was a competitive edge to it, in that, I mean, you're riding for a grade, they're teaching you how to show, you're riding for customers, because you, as a student there, you would ride horses that belonged to owners who sent them in for training. And so you were interacting with the public, and I was taking a lot of that as like pressure and like, And so, yeah, you showed up at a time when it was like a lifeline for the idea that you could control your emotions.
Uh-huh. Create in a very specific state of emotion. Yes. That would help you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you said the first time you were talking earlier, and I thought it was really interesting, about you weren't connected to your body, your mind and your body, I think you said, when the horse ran away with you. So to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
What
so
you mean
I,
by that?
I mentioned two different things kind of back to back. So I'll go in chronological order. So the first time that I had this idea of riding bridleless, I was, you know, I was back in high school and I had a barrel racing horse. And just to illustrate, like, I did not have control over my horse. And so I remember I came out of a arena where there was a chute that you would run out, and I couldn't get stopped past the timer. I couldn't get stopped as I left the chute. And we actually impacted a car that was parked.
Oh,
like,
my
we actually
gosh.
Hit a car. And so back in the day, everybody was like, you just need a bigger bit. Like, surely there can't be anything else missing here. It's just the bridle, you know? And so, you know, it was like, oh, okay, I need a different bit. And so this is the horse that I end up, you know, riding in a combination Hackmore gag bit. And I, you know, and I'm a trail rider and I do stuff. So my first thought on, like, you know, bridleless riding, I had seen a John Lyons demonstration. And so it was like, he's riding bridleless. I'm like, well, you know, in my mind, I'm like, take the horse out of the combination gag. I can ride in a halter for a while. And then surely the next step after that is bridleless. That was the one where I got run away with. It's not a recommended step. Like, you were missing some serious training steps, like, to do that. This is what I, so then from the time I was in high school and had that experience, I then went to college, which is where I met you, was learning all kinds of different things about training horses, understanding, you know, all this different stuff, and then had graduated. And in 2003, when I did that ride, So I had graduated from Findlay in 97. And in 2003, when I'd done that ride, I'd been showing and training for quite a while. So I had a pretty good foothold on, like, as far as training and showing and that kind of stuff with the bridle. When I made the leap from the time I dropped the rein in August until I went to the show in October, I guess the way I would explain it now is that at home, I didn't not have this awareness. I'm explaining it from this point of view, so we can run back and forth through whatever direction you want after this. But at home, like from the time I dropped that rein, what was really interesting is that year in 2003, I had finally declared to my husband, like, I want to quit horse training. I'm just done. Like, I am done. This is not what I thought it was going to be. I always joke that he thought I was like hormonal because I'd had three kids like back to back. And like we had like literally everything off the checklist of when we got married. Like we had the training business, we had the house, we had the indoor, we had a waiting list, we had the three kids, we had everything. And I was like, I'm done. And he's like, what is going on with my wife? And but the I'm done came from the fact that what I was after when I was a little girl in Maine and when I was like wanting all this stuff with the horses was the relationship part of it. And what I had ended up with was a horse training business that was very focused on like producing horses that would, you know, win or whatever. And I'm not even putting on to it like, I'm not even saying that this is like the fullest version of it. But for me at the time, I was like, this is just not worth it. I'm not mm-hmm. getting enough of that. That what I had this already once. When I was growing up, even though I'd hit a car, I loved my horse. and I loved spending time with her. And it didn't have this pressure surrounding it. Mm-hmm. And I had at this point equated like the business with the horses and the pressure. I had tied those two together. And I was like, I'm done. Now, the interesting thing about being at the rock bottom of like, I'm done, is it gives you a lot of freedom for creativity, because if it all blows up in your face, you're like, I was going back to work at McDonald's anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Like, I really did work at McDonald's when I was in college. And so I was like, done. So when I dropped the rein and I saw this like crack of opportunity, there was enough of me that was in that space that can open sometimes when you're in that like, I'm ready to start something new. So when I saw that, to me at home, it was, I would say that that what I went into was I went into possibility. I went into creativity. I went into what I sometimes call little girl dreaming, or like that Disney, like, I mean, growing up, I thought I was living in a Disney movie. Like it was like, I loved everything about being head over heels in love with the horses. I'm going to slightly pause here for a moment to tell you one. I'm going to confess something here on your podcast. So last night I'm laying in bed and I'm looking at my phone and my husband goes, what are you looking at? And he looks over my shoulder. He goes, are you seriously laying in bed watching a video of your mini that you just brushed its hair today? And I'm like, yes. And he had caught me doing this like 3 days before. And he was like, Oh
my gosh, that is awesome, Stacy.
I'm still looking for ways. I don't want to give that up. I don't want to give that up. I don't want to give up that feeling of That's being that enthralled. It's the magic. It's why I'm like, I don't have a problem calling it the Disney. It's the magic. I want the magic. And if that means that I've got a mini out in the barn that I'm fascinated with, I will keep magic in my horses forever. And uh-huh. that was what I had started to discover in that process at home, alone in the barn with the horse in August, September. But when I went to October, the crisscross of my struggles with tension in the show arena, that tension in the show arena met with me during that first ride. So the horse knew me as the playful way that I was at home, the creative open way. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to the show, I switched into a different state. And it didn't pan out well, mm-hmm. because she basically, what happened was we went in and I'd planned on going in, circling to the left, stopping in the middle, spinning, and then going off. And what happened was I went in a circle to the left, stopped, and I was so tense that usually after my stops, I stop and relax my body to stand still. I stopped and I didn't let go of the tension in my body because of what was going on in my mind. And the mare stood there and then was like, the only time she carries this much tension is for a rollback. And then I guarantee I blinked or did something and she just twing, like pinged off the rollback due to my tension. Mm-hmm. And then you can imagine if I'm this tense, like my odds of recovery at this point are, well, they were zero. I didn't recover.
Huh. So that is just so interesting. So I love that about the magic. And so you took a direction in your career that made sure that you had the magic.
Mm-hmm. It became a non-negotiable. Like, this will stay magical or I will leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love horses enough that I will have them in my life in a magical way. And if it has to become this other creature, I was just coaching a young lady who, you know, graduated from college a couple years ago. And she was like, I just became a pro and something has changed, but nothing has changed in what I'm doing. And I'm like, right, this would point to it changing in your mind. So then it becomes like, what are you making it mean that you became a pro? And so for me, it was this like, okay, I'm trying to fit myself in this mold over here. No, I want the magic.
Mm-hmm. So how do you coach your students about that? Or do you talk to them about that?
Oh, yes.
Do you? And I know I looked over the different podcasts that you have on your website and saw things like skill confidence versus self-confidence and riders being aware of their body. And how do you approach it? Do you approach it with, let's talk about you first and then let's look at the horse's emotions, or tell us a little bit about how you coach and teach and help people with their skills, but keep the magic.
Yeah. So I think I love, and now I've always loved writing, as in writing with a pen and paper. So I love writing, and I took writing classes. I've taken writing classes since graduating from college. I was always big into writing, and I always loved the idea that when you were writing things, there was a circular feel to them. There was like kind of, you know, you're the way the things open, the way the things built, the way the things close. There was this circling back and layering on. And so I think that what's happened in my teaching and just I really, really remember being influenced by these thoughts when I was in high school, because I just loved studying literature. And this idea of circling things around and around and around is how I learn and it's how I experience life. So therefore, it's also the way that I teach. So one of the ways that I teach is just by sharing the most open, vulnerable versions of what I've learned so that people can hear it from all different angles and see it from all different angles, fully knowing that they could, for example, listen to a podcast where I talk about it now, and then they could listen to that same podcast a year from now and have a completely different experience because they are in a completely different spot, even though the podcast is frozen in time. So I think there's the angle where I'm explaining and trying to do my best to explain it, you know, inside out, outside in, every which way. When I started my podcast, I was really wanting to figure out how to make it a framework that people could follow along with. So I, you know, took a piece of paper and basically had like a plus sign and just was like, everything falls into the rider's mind, the rider's body, the horse's mind, the horse's body. It's one of those four things. And typically it's a crisscross combination of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, every once in a while you get just, you know, my horse comes in and it's got a giant gash on it. It's pretty clearly just the horse's body, but like, but that pretty quickly jumps over into the rider's mind, how you're going to react to that, what you're going to do, you know, but what it's done for me is it's made it a little bit easier for me to kind of help break it into those things. Cause I think for a long time, I was way more comfortable just speaking almost the way that I like. So say when I went to college, they're just like, you know, well, if the horse is doing that, just pull on the left rein. If the horse is doing that, you know, use more leg. There's kind of there's a very body to body conversation that happens a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And I give my mom a lot of credit for the fact that when I was growing up, my mom still to this day kind of views life through that more magical way, especially with animals. So her dog has now has just recently passed away in the last, you know, year and a half. And so, but up to that, like she accidentally taught the dog like all these different toy names. Like, I don't remember how many, 20 something. It was like not just one or two. I mean, and she did it in a way that, I mean, if you were there, she was just having a conversation like, hey, Mr. Moose, go get the newspaper. Good job. Okay, Mr. Moose, put the toys away. You missed the Kong. Like, you're like, what is happening here? But it wasn't like it started out like that. You know, I've been around her enough to know the process she would have done. But to me, the number one thing when I look back that my mom was doing so naturally was expressing her emotions up and down in her body in a way that made it easy for the animal to read. For example, if the animal heads towards the wrong one and there's a tension in your body because you're carrying that tension of like, no, that almost like that coaching energy, like almost got it. No, not quite, like whatever. the dog's reading this stuff. Uh-huh. So yes, it probably took a while for the dog to like get it all isolated down to like names, which it did. but at some point it started out with just the pureness of the fact that my mom was willing to have that emotional experience up and down for the animal to read. And so a lot of times now what I'm coaching riders on is doing like getting this awareness, but also to the point where when they're blocking, you know, I find a lot of riders that are like, they're like, I'm frustrated with myself because I just keep getting this wrong. And I'm like, you do know that when you're sitting up there and you're frustrated, it's just oozing all over your horse. Just picture that frustration, like oozing down all over. They're like, ew. I'm like, well, your horse doesn't know you're frustrated with you. Your horse just knows you feel those vibrations that are not pleasant. And you know, things just don't typically go well. And it's not that different from my mom and the dog. And, you know, but the horse doesn't know what to do. See, my mom was using it in this thing. This person's like thinking they're in their own bubble and that the horse isn't experiencing this.
Right. So that they know how to selectively block.
Yes. And so, no. And so it's spending a lot of time trying to explain this from every conceivable angle.
How do you coach? Well, first of all, let's talk a little more about that idea of a rider's body and a horse feeling their body. I mean, that horse is feeling our body all the time. Mm-hmm. So how, let's just talk about it for yourself first, how you view that in communicating with the horse and how you put that with your mind. Because I think that's such a huge thing. And it's everything in bridalists, right?
It is. And that's where it's kind of interesting because I think that in the beginning stages and different things, I think, so I'll put it this way. It's like to get the top part where, let's just say that it's the bridalist and you've got that connection that so many people want, where it feels, you see it now with the growth of like liberty work on the ground and different things. This ability to communicate and it's so invisible. And you can see it definitely, you can still see it done with the reins. Like I've given so many demonstrations where I'm like, a really, really loose rein is the same thing as bridleless, you know, if I'm if they're not using it. But what's interesting is what it takes to get the top is that I believe what really makes it separate is when you go to the point where you're allowing that horse to be able to fully read you, which includes your emotions. Now, you can begin that right at the beginning. So you can begin that all the way down at the beginning. You can be teaching them how to read you and your cues. Like, let's look at those as two separate things. The cue is like, let's say the rein. So the cue is one thing, but then your emotional, like the, let's just put it yes and no, just to make it easy. So like when my mom was directing the dog and she's carrying a no in her body or a yes in her body with a certain tension, or joy, a bubbly joy feeling when it's a yes. And so when when I'm working with the horse, I allow myself that up and down. I allow myself like, oh, that wasn't it. But it doesn't have this like pitying. It's just like it's, but it's a heavier feeling when they're headed. Mm-hmm. I call it the warmer, colder game, just like we used to play as kids. Like you're getting closer, warmer, warmer, colder, colder, colder. And so you can, that can be a piece of it from the beginning, even while it feels more mechanical. Left rein means this, right rein means this. To me, the most beautiful overlap is when you can start them both at the beginning because then you get to the end faster. Having said that, you can do it all with just the mechanical and never allow the horse to experience that other side of you, that emotional side of you. But that's where I think when you get up to the end, you have a horse that doesn't connect with you because you didn't connect with them. Like you didn't mm-hmm. allow and invite that in.
Huh. So do you think of it as using your seat in a certain way? Are you using your voice? How are you communicating the emotion?
You know, it's all of the above, but really it's really allowing it. Probably if I say it like this, like a lot of people allow like a happy feeling. So I'll coach riders and they'll be like, good girl. Yes. Good. And then everything else is sort of like holding the breath. There's holding the breath and there's good girl. You know, it's not like so close. Like let's say I'm doing round penning. Say I'm round penning a horse and I want the horse to do an inside turn versus an outside turn. So I was just round penning a mini recently, so this might be fresh on my mind. Okay. And so the mini's going around the round pen. And I back up and I allow all this room where the mini could do an inside turn, but the mini doesn't because it's distracted. So it does an outside turn. So I run and kind of cut the mini off. Like I kind of quickly run and cut the mini off. And so there's this energy of this higher energy movement in me, but there's also like a nope, that's not it. Like cut it off. So there's a nope, not it energy inside uh-huh. of the running and cutting off. Mini goes the other direction. We're back moving counterclockwise. And so it's counterclockwise. I set up exactly the same situation. I start backing up. Minnie's going around. Hopefully, maybe Minnie thinks like, okay, there she is. She's blocking the space. I need to turn. Last time I turned this way. I'm going to try this way. They turn to the inside. Maybe uh-huh. I'm even like, yay. But for sure, there's this happy, this uh-huh. like just a way of being. Uh-huh. Just a way of being. And I'm telling you, you see this, and it probably is no accident that my mom also taught at a K-3, and that my aunt taught third grade for years. You know mm-hmm. what those teachers always do really well? They allow and show a range of emotion, not like uh-huh. wildly. They're not terrifying yes, small children yes. with it. But uh-huh. there is an energy of an up and an energy of a down. And that's uh-huh. the very, very basics of it in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And what's so interesting is that I actually run into a lot of problems with people feeling like they won't let that like, nope, not it. They won't let that one be there. They're all fine with like the, yay, good job. But they're not okay with the, nope, that's not it kind of an energy.
You know, as you're talking, Stacy, what's coming to my mind is when you're doing that up and down and yay, or that's not it, not quite, almost, or whatever it is, that it's not judgmental.
Exactly.
It's not saying, bad boy. Or, you know, you'll never get it or any of that. It's just being responsive to the situation. And I think that's where we all can get in trouble with a whole bunch of stuff with the judgment.
I think you're dead on. I think they think if they have the feeling of no or not right or not yet or that's not it or whatever the version of that is, they have this perception of it being a judgmental thing instead of a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, but when you're teaching the kids to drive a car, you're like, no, that's not it. Stay between the lines.
Yeah.
You know, like there's tension coming from like me in the passenger seat when I'm like, are we going to get stopped? You know, and you're trying to, but what is really interesting is just you know, it leads, as you've done different calls with me, it leads to like, you can, there's an animation in me when I'm teaching, when I'm talking, there's an up, there's a down, but you're right. The corrections don't feel like judgment corrections. They just feel like feedback of, nope, that's not it. You know, when I tell the mini, nope, that wasn't it. But I let there be this, no, that wasn't it. No's not everybody's favorite word, but it's this energy of like, nope, not that. Nope, not that. That's the contrast to the yes. That's yes. What makes it so clear. When it's just like holding your breath and yes, it's actually not the full story. And I would argue that in a way, when you're not telling both sides of it, that's where that blocked feeling begins at the very earliest. When you're not, and you block yourself just as much as you're blocking the horse, you know, and you know you're blocking yourself, which is what's blocking that. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it, horses find me easy to read.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think that when you say, no, not, that's not it, either to the horse or for yourself, there's a hopefulness. That's not it, but it doesn't mean you'll never get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I think we as people tend to do, is we think if we don't get it or if we make a mistake that we're, you know, not good. We're not a good rider. We, you know, we always make that mistake. You know, we go down a rabbit hole of all that stuff.
It's using your present situation or your past to determine where you're going in the future.
Uh-huh.
Which is completely crippling and holding you back, because you can get, I mean, I made lots and lots of mistakes to learn all the information that I did to get to the point where I could do the bridleless riding. And at any point where I had made those the end, I wouldn't have discovered it. You know, so it's like being able to make those mistakes and not hold a judgment against myself. And this is, it's so fascinating, I think, even when I say the word mistake or when I say the word no, it's so fascinating to realize how even I prefer the unspoken language of the up and down energy versus there's so many connotations that we have. You have to be so aware of your own reaction to certain words. Like, you know, so no or mistake or whatever that is, you know, because a lot of times when I'm coaching somebody, part of what we're doing is trying to find the language that works for them to produce that emotion. Because if I say that you need to have, like, if I go just for clarity of the podcast, if I just say that there's a yes and a no energy, and that doesn't work for the person who's listening, and they go out and they're like, no, you know, and the horse is like, whoa, like, where did you come from today? And they're like, see, that no didn't work or whatever. You're like, you've got to find this. And that's why I think I like going back to the, you know, the grade school teacher, or there's this playfulness with young children that we often use that's like a redirection, but there's a little bit of a, you know, there's this, you have to find the words and the way to view it that produce that energy. I'm just introducing the idea that the horses are so good. They handle no or not yet so good. I watch them out in the pasture together. And when my lead mare says, nope, they're all like, got it.
Thank you.
They relax into the clarity that comes from those ones that are just clear, but they're not, it's like, they're not angry. The horse is just like factual. And the horses do amazingly well with this factual kind of energy.
Yes. Well, do you have, when you said you had the quadrant of horse's mind, horse's body, rider's mind, rider's body, talk a little bit more about that. Just how you use that teaching.
The way that I see it being used is to just bring the awareness to the fact that there's at least these four different things going on. Because it's so easy when I was being taught that it was pretty much all on one side of the quadrant. It was all rider's body, horse's body. You know, it was very, you know, pull on the reins, release when it does this, you know, apply the pressure here, release the pressure there. You know, it was all very body. And that doesn't mean that that's not a piece of it. I mean, like, that is clearly a piece of it. I think that it's introducing the fact that the rider's mind is really in the driver's seat of all of it, because when you interact with that horse, you, the way that you perceive it, the way that you choose it, the way that you influence it, all of it, that's in the driver's seat. And that's influencing, you know, all of the, it influences, you know, when the horse does a certain thing, whether you decide to label it, he hates me, or whether you decide to label it, he's confused, you know, it mm-hmm. and so much of it, yeah. even when you take it down to the most basic thing of like, when I spend a lot of time in my courses and my live teaching, reading the horse's body language for them, you know, so they're submitting videos and I'm giving a breakdown of what's going on. But inside of giving the breakdown, I'm also saying what I'm seeing, how I'm interpreting it. And as you said, like a lot, so I'm interpreting it, you know, in a much more neutral fashion is typically what stands out. It's much more neutral. Versus the story that they have going on with that horse. And so it's so when even the interpretation of the horse's body is influenced by the mind. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I was just excited about what you were saying. So when you're watching the videos, you're interpreting the rider's mind as you see it in their body and the horse's mind as you see it in their body. Is that correct
mm-hmm.
or no?
Yeah.
Did I get that?
Yeah. So a lot of, yes. So a lot of times it's like, I might be watching a video and someone is asking the horse to back up through a pattern on a loose wrist. So they're doing groundwork. They're standing, let's say 6-7 feet in front of the horse. And they're asking the horse to back through a cone pattern in kind of an S shape, like maybe they're backing around, you know, and so we're watching the technique of like how they're using the tools, watching the timing of how they're reading the horse's body language, but also watching, there's one that's coming to mind, also watching where, you know, they're in the middle of this and then the horse maybe hears something off to the right side and like the horse is in the middle of backing through and then the horse just stops and looks and the rider drops the energy. Mm-hmm. And the horse switches like a light switch at this point and is like, oh, I see. There are some of these things that I can like, what other questions will you respond to? Like, if uh-huh. I look down here, what will you do? If I look up here, what will you do? Like, and so the horse is interactively playing with you. Because, I mean, if we want a conversation with them, then it's a back and forth. And so, but the rider's not identifying that when the horse looked off to the right, the rider dropped the cue system, whether that's because they had a thought, what is that loud noise? Or whether they had a thought, this one, it looked like the horse almost was thinking about scratching its side. And mm-hmm. so the horse looks off that direction and they drop it. Well, then it's funny how quick you can teach a horse to like reach over and scratch its side. You can teach them some funky things uh-huh. in the middle if you're paying attention to how all of that works. And most of the time people are like, really? And you're, oh, well, rewind and let's watch the video 3 more times. He was 100% with you. Then this happened. And then he started asking you, oh, how about all these other things? Well, what do you think about this? And it's funny.
Yes.
So then watch who takes the lead and who's responding to who. And so, yes, there is this, this totally circular thing because yes, I'm talking about their body and their cue system. Yes, I'm talking about the horse's body. Yes, I'm talking about the horse's mind because it did this and then the horse noticed this. But the funny thing is like, you didn't notice that once the horse did that and you did that, that you can rewind it now on the video and you can watch prior to that, the horse was having this whole, and then as soon as he detected this shift in your brain, that allowance of this, then he started being like, oh, how about all these other things? So we are talking uh-huh. about the your mind uh-huh. as mm-hmm. reflected in feedback from the horse.
mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Interesting. Really, really interesting. Well, so much of the person's emotions, of course, are always, well, the horses too, the person's emotions, you can see so much of what they're doing. And of course, they always precede it because, as you said, they're the ones guiding the whole situation.
Ideally.
Yeah. That's good. Well, talk about skill confidence versus self-confidence.
Yeah, that was another version of a little bit of what we've been talking about here, which is that a lot of times people want to practice the skills over and over again. And there's nothing wrong with practicing those skills. The difference between the, like, to bring it back into something we already talked about, when I did the ride, the first bridleless ride where I ended up with a zero because I didn't do all the maneuvers, I had the skills. I'd done that ride at home. I'd done that ride in paid warm-up situations. I'd done that ride in all kinds of different ways. I'd done that ride in the practice that morning in that arena. So I had the skills, but I didn't have the confidence. So that when I was approaching the arena, and you have to keep in mind, this was the, like, bridleless was, it was this brand new kind of a idea here. And so people, I was approaching the arena and people were like, are you really going to do it? She's really going to do it. They're yelling these kind of things as I'm going to the arena. So all the times that people kept asking me questions that were basically different versions, I was taking them for sure as different versions of doubt. Like, are you, what are you doing? What? You're doing what? You're going to go, what? How are you, what? You know, there was this feeling of doubt kept coming up for me. So I didn't have the confidence, the self-confidence in myself to remember to know that I already knew what I knew at home. I already had the skills. This is the reason I'm trying to separate it sometimes is, like, you can have, like, in, let's just keep it in this one. You can have, like, the confidence that someday you will ride bridleless. That doesn't mean you do what I did as a teenager and you just take the bridle off and see what happens. Like, you can. But we, without any of the skills, we typically know how this ends. And so there is a balance, this art of practicing the skills. But especially, I know your work, we know that the mental side of it is coloring. It is affecting those skills at some level. It might not seem like it the first day you give somebody a pony rod on your horse and it's super basic. It might feel like it's just skill. Left rein means go left, right rein means go right. You know, it seems super basic. But as you start moving up through and you start trying to accomplish more things and it starts getting more, that skill and that self-confidence, they come together. They do well if they come together. And so I literally bombed that competition because I let go of my own belief in myself. And it was the only thing I changed between the October ride, the December ride, was I just decided I can't control anything down at this, you know, ride at the fraternity, except I'm going to go in and do the ride I do at home. I'm going to go in. I'm going to go in and I'm going to do the ride I do at home. That is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in and do that. It wasn't like I'm going to try. I hope I do. It was like, I will go in and do the ride I do at home.
Well, it's so interesting because our horses, they are relying on us to be the same person in a, in a competition. I mean, they're like going, if we get all wigged out, they're going like, who is this? You know, I feel the energy of the place and I would really like it if you would stay with me because I could really use your support. And so that's, it's just interesting because it really is the same ride. Our horses are, that's who they are. That's what matters to them. They're not trying to go win $100,000 or win the ribbon or whatever. They're just waiting for us to be with them. So
it works so well when you can remember that.
Well, Stacey, one thing that happens with, because, you know, of course there's all kinds of riders and experience levels, and then there's horses of experience levels, green horses, really broke horses. And when people are learning and they have, let's say they're, you know, just haven't had a lot of experience or skill set is evolving like it has for all of us, and they have a really some riders have real high energy horses, very forward horses, and then other riders have really low energy horses, and that causes a lot of frustration. So how do you, let's talk about the high energy horse. How do you help riders with those horses?
Well, the first thing is just explaining the concept that you just did, which is like, there are horses that are high energy, there are horses that are low energy, and we have a lot of tools that we can use to help balance those horses out. So I have training that I can do that can make this, like I call it like on a scale of like plus 10 to minus 10 with zero in the middle. I can show you the tools that I use to take a plus 7 horse and make it look like a zero.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it becomes a zero. I can make it behave like a zero, but it's the reason I try to explain that to people is because without maintenance to maintain that, they kind of want to gravitate back towards their natural default. So if you have a naturally minus 4 kind of a horse, then that horse wants to naturally default back to that lazier side. If you've got a naturally hot horse, they kind of want to naturally default. So like I ride horses and they look like they're very well balanced, but that is because of the different training I've done to bring them to this level. That, and it requires a certain maintenance to be able to do that. And then we just discuss like, you know, are you up for that? That's kind of what you're signing up for. So, you know, if you buy an ex barrel racing horse and you want to ride 3 times a month and walk down the trail and it tends to be really hot, like, do we have a mismatch or what level of training are you willing to put in? Like, how is this going to work? Because we've got basically different individuals with different wants and needs, you and the horse. And, you know, and a lot of times riders are really interested in that's where you just have to really have the open conversation. Are you interested and willing to do what this horse needs? You know, because it's that. And then if we have the really hot horse, we start realizing, you know, we're going to do exercises that try to get that horse to look like the colder horse. We're going to do desensitizing exercises. We're going to be, you know, very clear and methodical, but we're also going to work within the realm of like, that horse probably isn't going to come off from 30 days of standing around and just go walk down the trail. Like, there's a little bit of an expectation thing that I like to just explain out there too.
I really like that. And what about the low energy horse? I think,
you know, the one thing that they really are. I was just coaching somebody the other day with one, and it's really interesting because some of the times when you've got the really low energy horse, they, like in this particular case, they have a lot higher likelihood of having lived a huge chunk of their life not well trained. Because a lot of low energy horses, people are like, oh, look, it's safe. Get on it. Oh, look, it's safe. Do this. Oh, look, it's safe. Do that. So a lot of the low energy horses are actually half as trained because nobody was really in physical danger around them. So they just didn't get the training. And some of those horses are just diamonds in the rough waiting to be polished because they contain so much potential, but because they weren't threatening someone's life on accident, you know, they got passed on by. And so the interesting thing is that it can create its own problems in that. So typically a high energy horse doesn't know how to come down and relax. And a lot of times a low energy horse is low energy, but if they get spiked up, something spooks them, they don't know how to recover either. Now, they naturally have a better shot at learning how to recover. Like, they typically grasp that concept fast and love it, but they also typically don't get trained it because they're like, oh, he's always been quiet. My mom's horse growing up was like that. He was like completely quiet, except 3 times a year when he would like lose it. And my mom would like disappear down like, and she's gone. Like, we don't know where she went or how far it'll be before she comes back. But like, he was super quiet. But that big wheel bicycle that showed up in the parade, like, he left. You know, and you're like, but once they get trained, they can really, a lot of times with the low energy horses, people don't like the amount of pressure that those horses can take. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of times out in the pasture, like I'll look at like I've got one right now and he's pestering enough that he's constantly pestering the lead horse. He's constantly missing chunks of hair. He's constantly whatever. This horse is telling you something about him. I'm not even involved. I'm just saying the way he interacts with the other horses in the field is informative. Like, you know, the little mare that I ride all the time that's a little bit hot and sensitive, she never has a mark on her. She runs away from all conflict in the field. If she can make faces and people and horses run away, then she's all about like pretending to be puffy. But when she actually knows that there's something around, she's like, don't want a piece of that, you know? And then I've got another one and I'm just like, goodness, how have you not figured out that when she says no, she's dead serious. That mare is like willing to take your hide off. And he's like, yeah, I know. I'm okay with it. Like, I mean, he's been living with her for 4 years. This is not a surprise. And so I think sometimes people deny that those horses are who they are.
Uh-huh.
In the field, he's telling me about himself by the way he's interacting with the other horses. And so then when I bring him in and the certain questions he asks me shouldn't be as much of a surprise because they're very similar. Like when he's like, what about this? How about this? What if I do this? How about that? Like he's got that same pestering kind of a mentality. And I just have to be really clear about, you know, what I'm doing. And he's very trainable. He's just, you know, what's actually getting him in trouble. He can't understand my mare's heat cycles. I think that's what's going to get him killed because she's much more inconsistent with her training than I am because she has times a month when she's like, okay, if you push on me, I'm okay with that. And then like 5 days later, he doesn't read her body language. And she says no. And he's like, you don't really mean that, do you?
That's funny. That's not unlike some human things, I think.
You're right.
Oh my gosh. Well, Stacey, tell us about what you do now. Like what is your focus? What are your interests? What are you doing?
Business, personal, where are we going with this?
Well, let's talk about business first and then personal.
Okay.
Or either way, however you want to go.
Yeah. So business-wise, I had been moving all of my teaching online prior to 2020. So that was kind of convenient when we all became, you know, a very familiar with Zoom and some of these other things. So I do my teaching and my coaching. I do predominantly online. I have courses that I teach, and there's a live element to those courses where, you know, if you're in my improving steering and teaching neck reining course, then you have an opportunity to get your video reviewed with me and get feedback. So I can say, you know, this is what I see. This is the next exercise you should do. When you go back and do this exercise, focus on this. This is what you're looking for. And I just released a establishing collection and teaching lead changes. And that has been such a fun course to build because I gave myself the challenge of building it with me not being the primary person in it. So I took students who had horses that didn't do lead changes and students that didn't do lead changes and taught the students how to teach their horses how to do lead changes. And that's the course. You get to watch Colleen teaching her horse how to do the lead change. You get to watch Bob teaching his horse.
So if when you get the video and you see the need, then do you make a video that shows them or you just coach them verbally?
They're pretty thorough courses. they're very thorough courses. And then I do like a monthly meeting inside of that course where it's a live Zoom call. And so I can coach them right there. I can coach them right then and tell them. And what I've done is I've done enough of them that some of the really common ones are already included in the course. Like I would say all the really common ones are included in the course because that's the nice thing about having a course platform that's much more mobile than back in the day with a DVD. I mean, in a DVD, you filmed it, it left, it was done. Now I can go in and add another module. I can go in and add another frequently asked question. And I can go in and I can see, you know, where people need that extra support. And so mm-hmm. I do that inside my courses. And then I do private coaching where people sign up and basically we do like a plan for where they want to go, we assess where they are. And then we start moving back and forth using the video review system, which has worked so well because it's a different experience to, like, if you take a live riding lesson, then you're there in the moment and you're learning. If you take a video lesson, so you videotape yourself and then bring that video to a lesson, now we're both watching you from the outside. Mm-hmm. We're both seeing you because a lot of times students are trying to make the change in the live riding lesson while they're doing it, and they don't actually fully absorb what they're not doing well, what's going wrong, where that leg is, because they're, as soon as they hear you, they're trying to fix it and they're not really aware of where it is prior to trying to change it. Mm-hmm. So I find that with the video coaching, I can be like, okay, do you see there where mm-hmm. this is what you're doing, where your release was right there? And mm-hmm. we can just rewind it and watch as many times as necessary. And they get these breakthroughs where they're watching themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's been super fun.
Yes, it is. It's really fun. And what about personally? Do you have any adventures coming up or something?
Well, I have a growing herd of minis. And I wanted to tell you, I ran a 10K for the first time this year. This was like a personal goal. Yeah, this was like a personal goal that I hadn't really put out there. Now I've talked about it a couple times on the podcast just because it was like, I was just marveling in it. But like, it's so fun for me to still figure out ways to challenge myself, whether that's with or without the horses. And the mind work, oh my goodness, the mind work to go from running a 5K. The first time I ran a 5K was 2018.
Uh-huh.
And the like when somebody told me like, oh, if you ran a 5K, you could run a 10K. I was like, I don't know if I believe you. And then the more work I did it, now standing on the other side, I'm like, oh, that was like 90% thought work and 10% physical changes. It was the craziest level of mind work because the
Talk
length
about
of
that.
Just
what
running.
Do you mean by that?
Yeah. So
what was the mind work?
The mind work was for me, like going out there. Tell me how classic this sounds like if you translated this to horse. The mind work goes like this. I think I will go ahead and run a 10K. Okay. Tomorrow I'm going to run 3/4 of that. And ow, that really hurt. And wow, I probably wasn't ready for that level of it. And okay, slow down. What do I need to do? Because my form when I was running the 5K wasn't good enough to support me running a 10K. It wasn't the form that could support me and my body. Like I was just barely skimming by on the 5K. I wasn't excelling at the 5K. It blew my mind about halfway through, maybe a little bit more than halfway through the 10K process. I was running like 3 5Ks a week. That just blew my mind. Like in the base training of it, you know, when it would be like, okay, go run for 45 minutes, go run for 45 minutes. And just because my base had been building and building and building. So the same thing that used to feel impossible just because of the structure of just slowly increasing time and running slower. Who told me that? Like literally they were like, slow down. If butterflies and people walking aren't passing you, you're not running slow enough. Like really go slow to build your base. Like don't try to run faster every time. Go slow. And it was like so counterintuitive to the idea. I mean, how many of these concepts sound completely like horse training? And that was me. And then the other thing was like to go out there and to be able to run slow and aware of my body meant that I had to stop listening to podcasts. What? I'm going to run for an hour without podcasts in my ear? I'm going to listen to my body for an hour while I run? Yes. And then it's just amazing, like all of the same revelations, yet in a whole different medium. It was just like this walk through the same stuff I teach and do, and yet in that way that I was the learner again. And uh-huh. and I was like, yes, when somebody tells me that this is, you know, that they're really struggling with this, I can raise my hand and be like, been there last week. Like,
how interesting. Well, good for you. Are you going to competitions? Like, are they? I don't know that much about it, really.
Yeah. So this, you're going to love this one, Barb. I love this one. So I hope you love this one. So I was prepping to run my first 10K and I wanted it to be an official like run. And so I was aiming for this run in September. And as I'm aiming for this run on the whole like schedule of like running, I get to the point where I'm out in the park and I'm running and I have one of these like Garmin watches that tracks your running and your heart rate and all kinds of other stats and stuff. Well, I get done with my running and it says like, congratulations, you've run your first 10K. And I had this moment where I went, am I allowed to celebrate that if I'm in the woods alone and this wasn't like the official one? Like I actually had the thought of like, I am actually doubting whether I'm going to give myself credit for this because it's not in an official capacity. This is literally what mind work is, people. This uh-huh. is what it is. Like when uh-huh. you won't give yourself credit because you're alone in the woods and you just ran your first 10K, but that's not good enough. This is your red flag.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Exactly.
And I was like, you're kidding me. Yes, uh-huh. I just ran my first 10K. Uh-huh. Yes, it was alone in the woods and only the Garmin witnessed it.
Uh-huh. Isn't it amazing when we become so aware of our thoughts and aware mm-hmm. of what's possible for us?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So much more freedom when you're actually like, you know, in that case, like, yes, you just did that. You get credit for that today, yeah. right now, because you're the one giving the credit.
Yes, exactly. It's your scorecard.
You don't need that yeah. external one to tell you whether or not you did it. Yeah. And so yes. Yeah. Yeah, so, but then I did turn around and do it in competition also.
I see. So, well, Stacey, thank you so much for being with us. I'm so grateful for you and your wisdom. And we've had such awesome intersections in our life. And I just want to share with people, you know, two that really stand out is that you and your family sold your house and took off on the road and were self-contained, your three boys in like a little bus and with a horse trailer, and stopped by to see Tom and me, and we had dinner, and that was such a treat. I mean, really a treat to see you with your family. That was an adventure. And then we got inducted in the Cowgirl Hall of Fame together. And that was really very, very special.
Yes, those are definitely two special moments. And I still make your potatoes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the Cowgirl Hall of Fame is pretty special. It's like a sorority.
Mm-hmm. And, yes.
Yeah.
That is pretty amazing. That's another one of those things that just still doesn't seem real at times.
I know. It's like, are you guys sure you got this right? Not about you, about me. So, yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. It's always fun to visit with you.
Yeah. Well, I wish your family well. Tell Jess hi and the boys and all the best. And keep up the good work and keep running.
Sounds good. I'm going to go hug a mini.
Okay. Sounds great. Keep the magic going. Okay. Bye-bye, Stacey.
Bye.
I so enjoyed hearing how Stacey allows her emotions to be expressed along with her cues and how important it is to stay out of judgment of ourselves and of our horses. And it's all about feedback, not judgment. Thank you for listening. And until next time, have fun, enjoy your horse, and be kind to yourself. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to The Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.